Channel 10. Welcome to a very special episode of Shutter Speed. I'm here with one-fifth of the team behind Photosynth, Blaze, Drew and Scott. Guys, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Very exciting day for you and the team, the culmination of almost 2 years' work. Photosynth launches today. Blaze, tell us about it. What's the announcement today?
Well, the announcement today is that for the first time, people are going to be able to actually synth their own photos and share those with the community.
So before now, it's been a technical preview. So I can go up to the live.labs.com/photosynth.
Or labs.live.com/photosynth.
That way, I'm sorry. And I can actually see a demo of what the end result is.
Right.
But what's different about today is I can create my own.
Sure. I mean, it's exciting to see that this is possible technically and to watch it run on your own machine and so on. But that preview was really only 5 canned environments that we very carefully put together ourselves. And this is what really turns that from a technology into a product. This is something that people can now play with on their own, build community around, do with their own material, find creative uses for that we never imagined. So that makes it really exciting. This is the point at which this really tips, I hope.
That's great. So, Blaze, I think some people, Channel 10 viewers, may actually recognize your face from a very infamous TED presentation from about 2 years ago. Now, that was the first ever showing a Photosynth, is that right?
Or? Not exactly. We had shown it in several places before, but to smaller audiences. I mean, at that point, it was really a SIGGRAPH paper. I wasn't actually one of the authors. That was Noah Snavely and Steve Seitz and Rick Zaliski. I sort of demoed a little bit of Photosynth with them when they gave their presentation at SIGGRAPH in August of 2006. This is the big graphics conference. But at that point, it was academic work. And so in those months between August and November, we showed it a few more times, I think, to small groups. But that TED video really took off virally, and it got millions of views. It was, and we expected that it was going to be exciting, but I think it took off even more than we anticipated.
Fantastic. So, Drew and Scott, just quickly, if I can get you, what were your roles in the development of Photosynth? Now, I know it's a very small team. I think Joshua Edwards mentioned about 15 people. So, Drew, what was your role? What do you actually do in terms of creating the technology?
So I'm a scientist at Light Labs, and I'm on the Synther team, and we've been trying to take the synthing process, which is the creation of the photosynth, the actual computation of where the cameras are and the points are, and turn that into something that users can run on their own machines, and make it robust and fast and reliable. And that's been a challenging task over the past 2 years.
And Scott, your role on the team?
I'm a program manager with the Photosynth team, so I'm responsible for the engineering to get the back end working, to get the network working, to get servers in the data centers, and put kind of the robustness around all of this scientific work.
Right. Well,
just to add weight, I mean, these guys, I think, both are at risk of being a little bit too modest here. I mean, this project is very, very unusual in that it combines a state-of-the-art computer vision algorithm, which I don't think anything like this has ever been attempted to be run on machines out there in the wild, on users on machines. And to contextualize that a bit, I mean, those initial synths, they took hours to run on clusters of machines. It was a really big deal. Noah's original demo in the summer of 2006, the Notre Dame thing that everybody saw on the TED video, took weeks of compute time on a cluster of computers. So what Drew and David Nister and his small Synther team have done is quite extraordinary in having really made that scale to the point where it can run in the wild like that. And as for Scott, I would say Scott and his team, but it's been almost just Scott. This is a Web 2.0 service as well. You know, so it really combines application and computer vision and Web 2.0 service, and it's up there with any other Web 2.0 service that has launched in memory and its complexity and then what's been involved. So
yeah, it's an exciting set of challenges because we're loading more user content than really kind of has ever been loaded before. I mean, you can upload snapshots or movies, but these are full-frame digital SLR kind of, 5, 10, 20 megabyte files, and dozens of them, hundreds of them, if you'd like. So there's some engineering challenges behind that.
Well, I'd love to come back to those challenges in just a minute. I just thought, let's just quickly brush over the very short or you know, the history of PhotoSynth. Let's talk about that first idea. Now, you mentioned before Noah.
Sure.
Who was a student, a PhD student, who came up with an idea.
That's
tell
right.
Tell us about the genesis of PhotoSynth.
Sure. So, yeah, Noah really is at the center of that story. If we want to contextualize that a little more, that field, photogrammetry and computer vision and the related disciplines, that has a long history. It goes back decades.
Wow, okay.
You know, ultimately it goes back to things like aerial surveys taken from biplanes and lots of hand calculations to figure out how those photos align and mosaic together and so on. But what Noah's really big insight was, I think, is that instead of trying to solve that grand challenge of computer vision, and I should actually back up for a second and say what that means, that grand challenge of computer vision. A lot of people know about graphics, 3D graphics. The idea there is that you have a 3D environment like a video game level or something. So you have the detailed information about the 3D environment, and you want to create a two-dimensional rendering of that from a certain point of view. So go from 3D to 2D. And that's a field everybody knows about. You know, Pixar does it. But the inverse problem, where you start from 2D and reconstruct 3D, that's really what a lot of computer vision is about.
Wow.
And so the grand challenge is start from photos or video and reconstruct something that looks like a video game level.
And now, there's also teaching or creating software technology that allows the computer to actually identify objects. Is that part of that challenge?
That allows the computer to identify objects. Okay, well, now you're starting to get into...
Well, I think that's a question I'm going to ask Drew, because I think that comes into the whole technology of how PhotoSynth works. And to the layman, how do you write a piece of software that says, here's two photos, show all the points where they overlap?
Yeah, so it's not actually identifying objects. Like
right.
This is a horse, or this is a table. It's more identifying this scene, you know, this part of this image. I saw this somewhere else, right? I think these match. So the whole idea is to go find features in each one of these images that you think you can maybe find in another image, and then you go look for them. And then once you have these correspondences, you think these points correspond to some point out in space. And so the whole goal of the phototourism project in PhotoSynth is to reconstruct the 3D location of these points and the camera positions from just the images that you have out there. And so you do this by...
So you mentioned features. What is a feature? Tell me what a feature is in a photo.
So it's like a blob. So we use a blob detector. And it's like...
And that's like a concentration of color or light?
A 2D point in the image. It's so, for instance, your face, if it's blurry enough, would show up as a blob. The buttons on your shirt would show up as blobs. You know, there are different scales and different resolutions. So that is what this 2D point in the image is what a 2D feature is.
Right. And so the PhotoSynth technology looks at two images, it finds these blobs or these features, and from there it works backwards to actually reconstruct this 3D scene.
Exactly. It comes up with a little description of a patch around this blob. It says, okay, here's the blob and here's what it looks like, and so it creates a little descriptor for it. And this is a little signature, says what this looks like. It says, okay, now I'm going to go try to find this and then all the other images. And so if something else has a similar signature, you say, well, maybe these match. And then if you can find the correct camera position to where these features all line up when you actually do the graphics problem of taking your scene and rendering it into your image, well, then you know that you have the right answer. But going through and finding out where the camera should go and where the points go, that's really kind of where the magic is.
And that's a lot of what your team's been working on, is you could think that this problem would get exponentially harder as you add more images, because everything has to get compared to everything else. And so making that work, you know, fairly linearly with number of images, it's kind of a big problem. So
that's a good follow-on question, because I think, you know, Blaise mentioned before that this first demo that Noah created with Notre Dame, and, you know, said it took days and weeks to actually put together, and now you guys have been able to create a piece of software that can, I mean, we just saw Joshua Edwards just did a demo for us, and he took 30 photos of a room in his house, and he synthed them together in about a minute. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that technical challenge. So how do you go from, you know, a giant room of servers that are powered, you know, that have an air conditioning to keep them cool, to a laptop that can actually do the same thing in less time? I mean, it's a huge challenge.
Yeah. you're looking at me, but I think really should be looking at Drew.
Well, maybe both of you. I mean, let's talk about that. How long did it take, and what are some of the challenges you have to overcome?
So we made significant progress by the time we released the original CTP back, 18 months ago?
CTP is?
Community Tech Preview.
Right.
So this was the original demo that Blaze was giving. And there we had made progress on speed, but it just was not reliable, and it wasn't nearly as fast as it is now. And we've been, there's been a lot of collaboration. So, you know, the MSR folks have been doing feature extraction, and
this is Microsoft Research.
Yes. Microsoft Research, yes.
Sorry, acronym mania here. But so they've been doing feature extraction and making that faster, this actual blob detection, coming up with better descriptors and signatures for each of the features. And so they've been doing a lot of work. David Nister joined our team shortly after the original preview that we had. And he's done just fantastic work on the actual optimization, you know, just figuring out where these cameras should go. And then we've just been really pounding on the problem, you know, just hammering on it and building test suites and, you know, evaluation platforms and just hitting all the problems. And it's just a lot of churning on it. You know?
And from what I understand, it's not necessarily just making the core math better, but it's finding kind of intelligent shortcuts and heuristics and samplings to try to probe certain things, and if that's a dead end, you go someplace else. Mm.
Yeah, it's really a pretty impressive technical accomplishment. One of the coolest outcome, I think, of all of this is that on at least with upload speeds the way they are in the United States, it turns out that they've gotten this thing fast enough now that on a typical synth, it takes less time for the computer to calculate those correspondences and figure out the 3D structure than it does to upload the images.
Wow.
Which is pretty amazing.
So the bottleneck is truly the internet connection in your house or your work actually back up to whatever the cloud is.
Not true in Tokyo, but true in the US. True in the US,
yeah. Most parts of Asia, but anyway.
Yeah.
Wow. So that's amazing. So let's just quickly recap again. You know, the synth is a client. It's about, I think Joshua was saying, somewhere about 8 megabytes to download. I need a fairly modern PC, but really that's it. All I need then is my digital camera. I throw the images into it, and it just reads them and creates these synths for us. Now, in the technical preview, we saw this thing called the point cloud. Mm-hmm. Who wants to tell me about a point cloud? What actually is that?
Well, the point cloud is actually the each one of these points that we found on the image, this is where we think it is in 3D space.
Right.
So this point cloud is all of these individual points. So basically, the entire scene has been boiled down to just a very sparse set of 3D points in the world. And this is where we guess they are. And so they have correspondences. Each one of these points has some point in the image that it's been seen by.
They were useful as part of the reconstruction, but they're also useful in that they look really cool.
Yeah.
And then spinning them around, even if you see just relatively few photos, you get a sense of space and where you are. So that had to stay.
This also cuts to the heart of the cheat, of the beautiful cheat that Noah did. Instead of trying to think about really reconstructing a game level or a 3D textured environment that looks like a game, instead he just went for the most minimal kind of 3D structure that would solve for where all the cameras are relative to each other and where the basic features are, and then project the original images onto reasonable flat planes from the right points of view.
What is that?
I have no idea what that was.
That was my lunch finishing. It was about the one cool thing about that point cloud is that on a small screen, because those points are colored, it kind of looks like this volumetric 3D model. Mm-hmm. So that cheat turns into something that, if you've got lots of overlap and great 3D reconstruction, looks an awful lot like the environment that you were in.
We could be doing a lot better with that, but... Yeah.
But it's still pretty good now.
Well, it is. I mean, the first demo I ever saw of Photosynth was internally within Microsoft, and someone had shown me one of the collections that is up on the preview site, and it was the Piazza in San Marco Piazza, I think, in Venice. And, just turning the actual photos off, so all you see is the point cloud and the little orange triangles that show where the photos were taken from.
It can be pretty cool.
But you could clearly see what it was that had actually been photographed, and then obviously turning the images on, you get that much more kind of context, I think.
Right. It varies a lot. I mean, sometimes, especially for things that look a lot like panoramas, where it's mostly just the user standing at one spot and taking lots of photos in different directions, there the point cloud is often going to end up very, very sparse. Mm-hmm. But in places like St. Mark's, you get beautiful point clouds, and the 3D experience really is good.
Well, let's talk a little bit about then the best practices perhaps for photographers. So Scott, you know, now this technology is available for everyone to access. Mm-hmm. I want to go out and I specifically want to take some photos that I can synth together. What are the best practices? What do I need to think about?
You might be tempted to go out and just take 500 pictures of every which angle, but that really actually won't get you very far in terms of the reconstruction and also how easy it is to kind of explore this space. Mm-hmm. So the ways that the viewer works, it's kind of one way to think about how you take pictures of the space. You might get little rectangles that you can click on and go there. You might have arrows left, right, up, and down. So if you start in a space, you start
in and out, don't forget.
In and out, of course, yeah, that's important. If you start in a space, you pick a reasonably good viewpoint and take a panorama. Just kind of hold your camera and turn around. It doesn't have to be on a tripod, kind of an arm's length. And then if you overlap a reasonable amount, two-thirds or so for each shot, and get all the way around, and maybe take a panorama up and look at the ceiling or look at your feet if the floor is interesting. And that will kind of provide a lattice that a lot of other things will hang off of. So from that point, if you've got a zoom lens...
A lattice, you mean like a baseline?
Like, yeah, just kind of like something that...
A starting point.
A starting point that other photos that you take will kind of stick to that. And you can be sure that the way the algorithm chooses your starting point, that some point in that panorama, if it sees enough other pictures, it'll kind of be the place that you start. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of be intentional about that. And if you've got a zoom lens, then you start taking pictures of interesting things that you can see from that point of view. And then if there's a wall that's interesting that's seen by that panorama, you can go and take some pictures of the wall like this. If there's some interesting objects in that space, then you can go and go around them. And I think it might be interesting to talk about what we do specifically to detect objects and the way that the navigation changes. But generally, as long as you can take a reasonable amount of overlap, and when you're zooming in and zooming out, taking pictures when you're walking or zooming, that you don't zoom more than about double the size of the frame, it'll all stick together.
I would also recommend, by the way, you said zooming. Zooming is good, you know, especially if things are off the ground and you can't actually walk in that direction. If you can walk up to something rather than using a zoom lens, I would actually recommend that above using a zoom lens, because then your field of view is more consistent and you don't have these sort of parallax effects that you get from zooming.
And really,
and reconstructions will be better as well.
Yeah, there's the second part of that, if taking pictures for reconstruction is interesting, because if you just stand at one spot, take a whole ton of pictures, and you're done, you won't get a point cloud, really. You'll get a little bit of a point cloud, but we kind of handle panoramas differently than when we handle full reconstruction. So if you make sure to take pictures of something of interest from a lot of different angles and have a lot of kind of baseline angle that separates those things, you'll get a better reconstruction. And that's where I pass the torch to you to explain
why. Yes. Yeah, so it's very interesting. So there's been a lot of research in finding panoramas. There's work that was done here at MSR, at Microsoft, on stitching panoramas, like, you know, the VR type, virtual reality type, you know, look around feeling to it. And there, you really want to put your camera on a tripod and not move the camera at all. Because otherwise you'll get artifacts in your panorama. But actually with Photosynth, the more you move, the easier it is for the camera to figure out where it's at, right? So it's kind of like when you kind of do your head like this, you're getting a little bit of parallax and you can start to estimate the depth. It's the same thing, our algorithm is doing exactly the same thing. So if you just sit here and turn around, it's very hard to tell what the depth is. But if you start moving your head like this, then it's easier for the algorithm to estimate where these points are, and the point cloud will be richer and more accurate.
Now, I wanted to quickly touch on the types of cameras that people can actually use to take photos for Photosynth, and I want to go to reference the CSI New York episode from a little while ago, where, you know, I think it was a prom night, and all the kids were taking photos on their cell phone cams and their handheld point shoots, and from that they reconstructed a photo scene. Now, I know that was in some parts, that was the magic of TV, although Bill Crow did tell us that actually on a previous episode of Shutter Speed, that the production staff actually did take photos and actually used the real Photosynth tool in that example.
Although not the pictures from the cell phones. So I think the real, I mean, there are a couple of different things about that were not very realistic. And one of them was that, of course, you can use cell phone pictures to do a synth.
Right, so that was my question. Can I use my cell phone?
But they're not going to be beautiful high-res images like they showed.
Could they be mixed in, though?
Like, they work wonderfully.
Right. So if I have, you know, let's say it's me and three or four friends and I go on holiday, and between us we're going to have a very different collection of technology. Someone may have a high-end SLR, someone may have a point-and-shoot, someone may have a Windows mobile phone with a camera. But I can actually combine all of those photos in the end and create a synth from multiple different technologies. Is that how it works?
Yeah, you bet.
Absolutely. And really, C-Dragon, the underlying technology that allows you to kind of zoom smoothly through all of these photos and look at the detail, doesn't really care in terms of performance whether it was a 500 megabyte TIFF or whether it was a pocket camera. You really only start to notice the difference in other than just the image quality that you see, when you start to zoom in. Mm-hmm. And if you were using a Canon 5D, you'll be able to zoom a lot further than if you used a camera phone.
So Scott, Blaise mentioned before that Photosynth really is a Web 2.0 application. And I think when a lot of people hear that term Web 2.0, they kind of, one of the words they associate with is the cloud. So the question I want to ask is, why, with the launch of Photosynth, did you guys choose to have a client people download and run on their PC as opposed to a cloud service? What was the thinking there?
Well, a few things are really easy to do in the cloud. Storage is pretty easy to do in the cloud. Compute is something that, although you can do it, to the degree that we need to do it for Photosynth, it really doesn't scale the way that we wanted to, that we wanted it to, at least for this first shot. Also, I mean, if you think about the ecological perspective, users have their PCs running, they can run it. Otherwise, we have to build these big, gigantic data centers and have servers cranking on this problem all the time. So that, from a practical point of view, the engineering challenges were big. And I think that when we start to go about the compute and the cloud thing, start to actually do that, we're going to have special software that specifically works extremely well on parallel computing with a lot of different shared storage. And so it's a different engineering problem.
So was there some research done, perhaps, to
I would actually like to just expand a little bit on something that Scott just said, which he mentioned briefly, but I think this is actually a very important point.
Okay.
I mean, we think about cloud computing as something that happens somewhere else. You know, this is just somebody else's thing. And, it's the magical interweb. That's right. I mean, those computers are, those are bunkers full of machines with dedicated cooling systems, drawing enormous amounts of power. You know, some of them have been built out in eastern Washington, where the power is relatively cheap. This is a huge kind of engineering and power consumption and resource intensive sort of thing. So it's not like because it's in the cloud, it's somehow free. And if your computer is on and you're uploading your photos, this is a beautiful chance, to be using those cycles to let your computer do the lifting, to push that out to the edge as much as possible. And I think that's a model that we really are going to be exploring for a lot of different sorts of things, how we can push computation out to the edge in order to make the best possible use of resources.
Right. And also, just elaborating on Scott's point, was there perhaps some research done to show that the average computer out there in the hands of the photography enthusiast that's going to want to use Photosynth will have, I mean, we just, Joshua Edwards just showed us a demo on his laptop, and it took him, I think it was a minute, maybe 60 seconds to synth 35 photos. And perhaps, did you guys look at what would be the average number of photos and the average machine, how long that would take versus let's invest in some infrastructure and, build some bunkers?
Well, I mean, your average photography enthusiast usually has got some serious hardware. I mean, we didn't want to limit it to that, but of course, if your machine will run Lightroom or Photoshop or Windows Live Photo Gallery well, it'll certainly do a good job with synthing. But that wasn't really specifically what was kind of driving our decisions, really. It just happens to be that demographic has good hardware.
Well, it's also lucky that, as we mentioned, that the upload speed that most people have, the amount of time that it takes to upload, 100 photos or 200 photos is substantially longer for most people's connection than it takes to actually generate the Photosynth, to actually do the computing. So if you're uploading photos anyway, right, the small amount of time that it actually takes to do the computation, well, we should take advantage of that.
There's also the scaling issue. I mean, if the same thing happens with this release as happened with the TED Talk, and it really takes off like gangbusters, then we don't want to be stuck in the situation where suddenly we're very limited in terms of our server capacity,
right,
and installing another 10,000 machines.
Mm-hmm.
Right, exactly. That happens, and it could happen to us anyway.
Wow.
I mean, but at least it's going to be a storage problem and a database problem, and these are much better understood things that can be scaled up much more quickly.
Okay.
Thinking about scaling up synthing to handle that demand is scarier.
There's also another interesting design choice, is that if you're uploading the synths, as soon as you finish uploading your images, the synth is there and you can go look at it. Whereas if you were just uploading your photos, then you had to wait, there would be some latency before you could actually see it if it was being done server side.
Yeah.
The kind of instant gratification was another design choice that we looked at.
And if you contrast that with a lot of video sharing services, you upload your video and they say, great, we'll email you when it's done.
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't quite give you that same feeling of gratification. So
let's talk about sharing though. So I created a synth and I want to share it with my family. It's a family gathering or something. I've synthed those photos. What scenarios does this current release support in terms of actually sharing your synth and showing it to other people?
Well, so one of the things that we quite deliberately didn't do in this first release was really provide restricted access or buddy lists or a way of using the service to share with only a few. And I know we're going to get some flack for that.
Okay.
That's, you know, that's something that, to the extent that this is useful and valuable and is a good thing to use, people are certainly going to want to do it in smaller, more private groups.
Right.
So that may very well come. But what we wanted to do in our first release was to really maximize the amount of utility to the entire community of people's efforts, of our efforts, of their efforts. And that means things that get uploaded are shared with everybody. We're very much focused on this sort of one-to-many model.
So every synth that I create and that I choose to upload is really accessible to anyone.
Right, and in fact, we're not even giving you the ability right now to create it and not upload it and share it.
Oh wow!
So those are all. That's right.
That's part of
the whole thing.
That's right. Cool. So it's probably important then, I think, for people to realize when they are creating a synth that synth is actually going to end up on the web, and so to make sure they use images that first of all they own the copyright to,
mm-hmm.
and second of all they're happy to actually be up there on a publicly viewable site.
And if you review those images too, you're going to be uploading high megapixel images, and you catch minute details that you might not know that you're uploading. The CSI stuff we caught, the director, the producer, some Microsoft guys, and you might find that as
did you find out who the killer was?
I think that was quite intentional.
Oh, okay.
We did discover it in there. It was quite intentional, but.
Cufflinks or something.
I think that was the hook. That was the hook.
I just spoiled the episode for everyone.
Yeah, that's right. Right. It's a lot like the street view technology, where you might catch somebody walking their dog on the street and you didn't know that was there. Similarly, you might catch things in a photo sense you don't expect. But that's kind of part of the fun too, is looking for Easter eggs in other people's photos.
So. Now, what's the you mentioned before uploading 100 or 200 photos. How many photos can I synth in a single collection? Is there a limit? What's the restrictions?
So a few hundred, is typically what people are doing, and that works well. And that's kind of what most people will have the patience to actually upload, and where we start having memory issues and computational issues on the client side. But
it's a bit of a soft limit.
If you've got really small images or black and white images, that limit goes higher. But really, the results that you get after doing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of images, it really tails off in terms of the quality of reconstruction and the navigability of that experience. It starts to get cluttered and
more is not necessarily better.
Absolutely.
Definitely seems to be a sweet spot around, a couple of hundred, 300,
maximum.
As far as just, viewing it.
You can make a very beautiful synth with 20 photos. I mean, there are examples of very beautiful synths with very small numbers of photos as well.
Yeah.
So would you guys recommend perhaps doing a larger number of smaller synths than trying to actually put all your photos together? Or what's perhaps the best practice for that particular example?
I've shot situations where I'll take tons and tons and tons of photos, but I'll go through afterwards and pick the ones that not only represent kind of good coverage, but also each photo is you would want it to be well composed, mm-hmm. you want it to be interesting to look at. This is not exactly video where you kind of swipe around. This is more like you take intentional shots. And so picking the quality of the photos you actually include is important, because mm-hmm. they'll be seen.
Although having said that, Scott, I have to say, when you look at your photos afterwards, it often can be very hard to understand just from the photos. I mean, in a way, that's the value of photosynth. Photosynth connects them together.
Right.
If you're just looking at the photos, it can be quite hard to tell where you'll have enough coverage and mm-hmm. so on. So when you say select subsets, I think that's valuable in that you can take strips or ranges of photos and say, I'm going to not include that range, not
sort
include that
time,
range. But,
and,
right.
I wouldn't recommend...
But not one by one, right.
I mean, you can do it, but mm-hmm. only if it really makes a difference.
So the synther will try to figure out, if you throw in things that are disconnected, it'll create different little clumps of photos in the sense. So it'll recognize when you have breaks, and it'll just try to reconstruct two different reconstructions. And, so you don't have to be too careful about that. Although, if you want to have something of, your vacation, and you had the beach, and you had a house, and they're not going to connect, well, maybe it's better to actually have those in different collections.
Sorry.
Now you mentioned previously that there's a soft limit of maybe a couple hundred photos per synth. Now, what about if I've gone on holiday to Thailand, and I went to a particular location in Thailand, and I took photos and I created a synth? My best friend went there a year later, same place, took mm-hmm. another collection of photos. Could I perhaps, for want of a better term, synth two synths or multiple synths together and actually combine synths that have already been created. Is that something that you guys hope to either support now or in the future? How would that work?
So that's not something we're supporting now, but it's definitely on our radar. And that was one of the original visions of the phototourism paper that Noah and Rick and Steve Seitz all worked on, is to take these community collections and build an environment from it. And we're expecting that we'll get lots of different people uploading synths that correspond to the same environment. And it's definitely something that we're going to address, is merging these together into, you know, one cohesive representation of the scene.
And the thing that actually excites me more than just a bunch of photos from different people of the same spot, that is, either crowdsourced photography of one spot or a synth of two synths of the same spot, is when you start to have synths that connect but that are distinct in, right, in space. And at that point, if you imagine starting to make those sorts of connections, that's where you start to get into this sort of immersive, can we really wander through very large spaces in a continuous way?
Could we one day perhaps even synth the entire world, really, by, everyone, I'm sure a digital camera has been in pretty much every place on Earth at least by now. Imagine if all those synths...
Well, practically speaking, I think it's not crazy to think about those sorts of scenarios in urban cores, for example. But, there's a lot of space on Earth that's either lacking in features or, lacking in people pointing cameras at them. I mean, there are a lot of photos taken, but the distribution of where those photos are taken is extremely peaky. The lot in certain places, very, very sparse in others. I don't think that's going to change dramatically anytime soon.
So I think a lot of people watching this video, I would hope that once it's finished, they're going to go to photosynth.net and actually download the client and start. And I think a lot of photography enthusiasts will specifically go out and probably capture some photos specifically to create a synth. But the question I wanted to ask you guys is, do photographers, amateur and enthusiast photographers, do they need to actually change the way they go about taking photos? Or was photosynth created as a tool to kind of just fit around the way people are already taking images? It's obviously a balance between the two, but what's the philosophy behind that?
So there's an art to taking a good picture.
Right.
And there's an art to taking a good panorama. There are some very good panorama photographers out there that compose these beautiful things. And similarly, there's going to be an art form that emerges around taking photosynths. There's going to be ones that navigate well, and there's going to be ones that maybe don't, I think there's definitely going to be a creative, artistic aspect around this, and we've seen some people take some very stunning, compelling synths.
And others that kind of suck. And some of the ones that suck, have the property that lots of individual photos in those synths look great.
Right.
But something about the way those photos are distributed, just isn't very compelling as an environment.
So what are perhaps some very quick examples of synths that you've seen in terms of not necessarily the technique, but more the subject that worked really well and some that worked really badly? And the reason I ask is I remember that I think Bill Crowe was telling me that there are challenges when you try and synth a very shiny surface like a car. Apparently a car is very difficult to synth. Is that something you want to talk about?
We went to a Lamborghini dealership and took pictures of shiny black cars on a shiny black floor. And it all hung together, but...
By a thread.
Yeah. It was really, really challenging. We had to take about five times more photos than we thought we needed. But if you wanted to, say, go to a beach, take pictures, the sand works beautifully. If you want to have exposed brick or wood or texture, carpets, a lot of carpets work beautifully well.
So you're looking for textures and patterns and less reflection? Is that a good kind of guideline?
The thing about reflective surfaces is that those little spots of reflection move when you move around, and not in the way that the reconstruction would expect.
Well, and if they're really reflective, of course, then most of what you see is, in fact, from somewhere else in the room. It's not that surface at all, and that doesn't transform in the same way as you move the camera and so on. So,
Best synth you've seen so far, and perhaps something unusual where you saw someone took some photos and you go, whoa, that actually works really well. Scott, anything come to mind?
Chihuly?
Gosh, yeah. There was a Chihuly exhibit at the De Young Museum in San Francisco, and the staff photographers for Chihuly took these beautiful, beautiful long exposures on tripods and very labor-intensive synth. But each photo is beautiful, well-executed. But there's so much coverage of this glass that's so contrasty and reflective against this deep black background, and you feel like you have this art piece popping out of nowhere, not only because the synth itself, the user interface, has a black background and these things are colorful, so you feel like you're actually in the space, but the subject matter is so beautiful to look at all the different scales, that it just is a great combination of things.
Yeah, that's a gorgeous one.
Some other examples, perhaps? Or?
So some of the ones that I like are ones where you almost forget that you're viewing a photosynth. And we've seen some of people doing very interesting, like climbing mountains.
I was afraid you were going to say your playhouse. That's good.
Yes, I do have a few test sequences of my backyard that
we've all seen far too many times.
Really sick of right now. So,
But your mom loves it, so let's go.
Yes, absolutely. But you know, it's where something is going on. Like, you know, where there's something interesting. Like we've seen people climbing a tree. So Ken has this sentinel tree. I don't know what the sentinel is.
Gigantic tree.
Huge tree, and they're climbing this tree, and the point cloud on it is fantastic. But as you're looking around the synth, you know, you're kind of just watching the action go on. You say, well, I want to see what's happening. And the whole navigation of the viewer, the photosynth viewer, is just kind of a nice way for you to explore the scene and understand it. And you almost forget that you're looking at it. And if you had to look at 1,000 thumbnails of the scene, it would be excruciating. But now it's this very fluid way to understand the environment.
So. And in fact, what Drew is alluding to is a storytelling aspect to photosynth that's actually sort of orthogonal to the spatial navigation. So if you just go next photo, next photo, next photo, and those photos are taken in a way that tells a story, like a rock climber going up a cliff, or I have one where I shot a couple of my friends jumping up and down on my power stilts down the street.
Power stilts?
They're not actually power, they're springy.
The
springy
jump, okay.
Right, yeah. Velocity boots, whatever. Yeah. And it's pretty cool. You know, you see them jumping down the street. It's not like this is the greatest synth, but that particular application is an interesting one, that kind of combines the fact that these are coherent in space with the fact that those are actually individual shots taken over time.
What application do you think is there for photosynth as a tool for photojournalists and photo news journalists to actually, you know, I think if you're an editor of a newspaper or a magazine, you really only have the ability to choose one, maybe two photos to convey a scene. With photosynth, you could actually include the entire set of images of something that's happened, whether it's a, you know, a celebration or even, you know, a tragedy or, you know, something that's happened in a war zone. So do you guys see an evolution of photosynth as a professional storytelling medium for
very,
news?
Very much. I think it's worth comparing and contrasting a little bit with ordinary photos and also with video. Because, of course, both of those are used extensively in media to tell stories that way. Photos are sometimes used in the format of interactive slideshows. Mm-hmm. That's really started to become very popular. I think a video forms an interesting point of contrast because in video, of course, you can explore an environment and do something like that. But the thing is that the playback of a video is linear. It takes the same amount of time to experience that it took to shoot modular editing. And the difference with photosynth is that the experience is nonlinear, and it lets you really go exactly where you want to go quickly and explore selectively. And in that sense, you can tell a much richer story through photosynth than you can through video, and make that story at the same time much more nonlinearly accessible.
Do you think perhaps one day in the near future we'll see a Pulitzer Prize for a photosynth?
I hope so. I certainly hope so.
Yeah, I mean, I love seeing the Pulitzer Prize photo essays, and they're usually a collection of 20 photos that have some kind of relationship. Mm-hmm. I wonder if we could see a photosynth.
I very much hope so. And this, there's also a quality issue that I think is very important to all of this. I mean, video tends to be pretty low quality. The resolution is low. Even HD video, which, you know, we think is a big deal, is a terrible resolution compared to an $80 digital camera that you can buy in the street. And so the fact that you can deliver all of those pixels, all of that resolution, you can zoom in and really see the details, I think is pretty potent. So it really combines the best of both that way. And in a way that looks and feels really like an entirely new medium.
No one's mentioned the art sense and museum and gallery sense necessarily.
Extraordinary, right.
But to me, when I first joined this team, that was the absolute most compelling thing for me immediately, is to be able to link super high-resolution scans of artwork that you can get so close that you'd never be able to get that close in the gallery.
See, like brush strokes and thumbprints.
And textures and the grain of the...
Canvas.
Bits of brush embedded in the impasto, you know, whatever.
Yeah. All the way back into the gallery, and then you're looking at the space, and then you can navigate again. I can't wait for the museums of the world to be available to anybody at any time for any reason.
So the next question, I think, at least in my mind, is how will Photosynth evolve? And to that end, let's talk about what's coming in the future. How can Photosynth evolve as a tool that, you know, maybe I'm an artist and I have artwork hanging in my home, maybe I own in a gallery. Or you know, how can Photosynth be used as a tool that people can use to tell stories or to actually provide richer context on gallery or the works of art that someone's created? What's the future for Photosynth in that sense?
Well, the thing is the technology as it exists in the technology preview or in the product that we released is pretty general purpose. You know, you can go and you can go to a web page where people's comments are and you can share it.
Can I embed a synth perhaps on a website?
Sure, you can. Mm-hmm. You can embed it like a movie or an image. But we can host individuals or organizations. But I expect that as time goes by, that core technology will be extended in ways so that the metadata and the information that you see as you're exploring could be surfaced, you know, in a web interface or as you're navigating around. There's research that's been done that I've seen recently where the closer you get to certain objects, you get sound or you get other metadata. So this core technology, I think, has some legs and it's extensible enough that there's no reason that other individuals or groups could take it as far as they want it. So.
And along those lines, it's not, we certainly have been very careful to provide the ability to embed, so that other organizations, other people, blogs, whatever, can put synths as first class citizens into their own environments, into their own environments on the web. We also have put a lot of thought into the mashup ability of Photosynth, mm-hmm. and I imagine some very very interesting things can be done by clever hackers combining Photosynth with other sorts of things happening on the webpage.
And without specifically talking dates, what is the plan for the team moving forward? What are you guys going to be working on next? What's the evolution of Photosynth? Is this something we can talk about, or we're going to...
Well,
because you mentioned before, for example, that a collection you create is kind of automatically public. Will we see more of a community element where you can have, you know?
Sure. I think that's something that, I mean, it's obvious to everybody that at some point we're going to have to start providing those other sorts of capabilities for you to.
And perhaps will cloud services come into it sometime in the future, or is that really contrary to the philosophy behind Photosynth?
No, cloud services are very important in some situations, especially if your device doesn't have the horsepower to do the synth, and that probably is the case if your device fits in your pocket, for example. And that scenario is a very important one because most cameras nowadays are in fact connected to devices that fit in your pocket and have a little antenna on them. So we are going to be looking at cloud services. We are going to be looking at video. We've already done some research along those lines, and it's an obvious place to go. We're going to be looking at user access controls, at richer community features, tours, things like this. We are hoping that a lot of those future directions we're going to be very public about and really allow feedback to inform what parts of that get developed first in what order.
Fantastic. Well, guys, thank you very much for your time. Photosynth is an amazing product, and I think it's truly an evolution in digital photography and the way people enjoy and interact with their images. If anyone out there in Channel 10 land wants to actually go and see your synths that you've created, do you have a username, or how can we actually point them to the collections you've created? Because it sounds like you guys probably have some pretty good synths up there on the web.
Some.
Yeah, can we find
especially
it?
Scott.
Is that information you want to give out?
Search for Scott.
Yeah, Scott. Scott.
Steedley.
And Blaze.
Great. So. And we'll check out your Photosynths. All right, guys, congratulations, and hopefully we'll be seeing you guys in the near future, and we'll talk about some new cool stuff coming up with Photosynth.
Thank you so
much.
Thanks very much.